Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone. Happy Thursday. I am so happy to be here. I've been tweeting, I've been putting messages on LinkedIn around this because we have a powerhouse today. I'm Scarlett Sieber. I am Chief Strategy and Growth Officer at Money 2020. Big into fintech, playing a lot of time all around the world of fintech, and definitely big into women empowerment. So I am so excited about our session today. We're going to be talking about the role that social media plays in the momentum of online investing. So much of conversations that are happening around the globe are the move to digital. This has been a trend that was definitely started pre-COVID, but is now totally accelerated post-COVID. So I have three incredible women with me today. I am not going to tell you all about their backgrounds. You're online right now. Google them, look them up. You're going to be impressed. So I will introduce each of them quickly and I'll say their names and they will each give you a one sentence synopsis of who they are. So I'll set all three of them and then Lisa will start with you. So we have Lisa Carmen Wang, we have Katy Perry and Megan Loist. So Lisa, tell us who you are.
Hey everyone, I'm Lisa Carmen Wang. I am currently the Global Head of Brand and Communications at Republic. I'm a former USA national champion gymnast, turned serial entrepreneur, angel investor, and unapologetic feminist.
Woo! Okay, so we got a gymnast up in here. Let's go for it. All right, Katy, what about you?
I gotta follow the gymnast and entrepreneur. That is so cool, Lisa. Hi, everyone. I'm Katy. I'm the VP of marketing at public.com. Maybe don't Google me. Obviously, my name will yield different results, but really excited to be here with these women to dive into these topics.
Megan.
Yeah. Hey, guys. My name is Megan. I'm an investor at Lear Hippo. We're the most active early stage investors in New York. And I'm also the founder of Gen Z VCs, which is the largest and fastest growing community and now movement for Gen Zers in tech and VC. So we have just about 9,000 people now in the community. So really excited to chat with these amazing women about all things online investing.
So one of the things that I love, and total kudos to Yield Street for putting this group of amazing ladies together, is how different all of your backgrounds are. But there is a lot of synergies and overlap when we're thinking about investing. So we got gymnasts, entrepreneurs, people in media, marketing, and VC. I mean, it's a crazy world coming together. And I definitely want to hear offline, Megan, more about this 9,000 group of, you know, Gen Z VCs. I'm sure there's a lot of cool things that we can do there. So I want to make this as engaging as possible for all of you. Please make sure too that you ask questions. I've got 400 questions I could ask, but we want to make sure that we incorporate your questions. So please ask them. I will do my best to interject them into the conversation. But with that, let's go ahead and get started. Okay, so I talked a little bit about the onset about this idea of the move to digital. One of the things that I've found so fascinating about what's happened, and I hate over talking about COVID because we're all kind of like COVID fatigued, but I think one of the things behaviorally that's interesting about it is the move to communities and how people were meeting in different places historically in person, and how in some cases the communities have gotten even stronger because they've been able to expand across the world. So I would love, Lisa, maybe let's start with you. When you think about the role that community plays for people, specifically with an investing, you know, lens. How does community impact the, you know, the ability to invest and, you know, educate others from a community online perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing about community is that when done right, what it creates is a safe space for people to feel like they belong, to feel like that they're around values aligned people. And I think investing to date and just financial markets in general have been very daunting for a lot of people who don't have that access to education. You know, it's never spoken to women, it's never spoken to minorities. And I think that we are coming to a place where people are curious. They want to learn. They want to build wealth. You know, it's the student loan debt right now is just off the charts, and people are realizing they cannot build wealth if they're just working. They need to figure out ways to invest in alternative asset classes and to diversify their portfolios. And the problem is, without those communities, they don't know where to turn. Because that education, you know, it's always been focused on FOMO. It's been focused on, you know, like if you don't get in, you're going to miss out. Everyone else is making money and you don't know how to do it. And so that's why I think community is so powerful right now, because it's really when you create those safe spaces, it starts eliminating some of that economic, social, and geographic barriers that have historically existed that have not allowed more diverse people to get access to these sorts of investment opportunities. So, you know, with some of these platforms like Republic, like public.com, you know, there people have the opportunity to invest in everything from stocks to startups to crypto to real estate, and being able to learn about what it is they're passionate about and actually invest in the future they believe in.
Yeah, I think you highlighted a lot of key points there, but one of them is the FOMO component of it. And it is interesting, right? Because I have a pretty diverse background. I've been a cocktail waitress in New York. You know, I've done a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So I have friends from acting to modeling to whatever else. All they know now is that I'm in finance. And so anything finance related, they come to me. And what I've seen more recently is this idea, the FOMO, I have to be part of this. What is happening? What, you know, what can I do? And it's like, well, there's so many ways I need to answer this question. I can't just say, go do this. The idea about the education combined with community, it's okay to not understand. You don't just want to do it because, oh my God, you know, pants on fire over here. Let me go put my only savings. Like, that's not a smart investment decision. But what would be is you spending time thinking about the logic behind doing that and having a group of people around that. So Megan, anything you want to add to that from your perspective when you think about that idea of community and the impact on investing?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think like Lisa mentioned those safe spaces. I think Gen Z VCs is kind of the definition of what that's become, especially for the next generation. It was a community that was born during COVID, a way for me to just sort of make friends in the VC world because everything was virtual. And what's happened over the coming months is it's become a community, not just for, you know, investors, but also it's aspiring investors who are learning about investing for the first time, company building, and angel investing. Like there are people that are able to, you know, find companies and invest their first capital for the first time. So I think having these communities where it's centered around learning and giving, you know, it makes it a very low stakes way for especially the youngest generation to really get their feet wet and learn about opportunities from an educational standpoint.
So really quickly on that, you made me think of some things. When we talk about the fact that this was born as a response to COVID, from a VC's perspective, someone who is a bit earlier in their career, who you've really got to make your mark. How do you think about, because so much of when you articulate your value add to these portfolio companies or potential portfolio companies, it's, oh, it's my network, it's this and that. And now with COVID, some of that was taken away. So I would love to hear a little bit more about how you were able to replicate or maybe even enhance that network virtually in response to this.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I didn't have a personal brand or really know anyone when I started in VC. Like, candidly, I'm 24. I started in September, so this is my first job in venture capital. And I could maybe count the number of investors that I knew on one hand, let alone my network of founders to be able to add values to portfolio companies. And I think what was great about Gen Z VCs is we went from, you know, a group of small 30 investors that I founded from 30 people to 1,000 in 4 days. And then now 6-7 months later, we have about 9,000. It's enabled anyone to really build their network, like whether that is sourcing deals, finding angel investments, meeting friends in the community that are beyond your city. I think that's one of the benefits of like online community specifically is like I live in New York, I'm from New York, but now I have friends in Dubai and London and San Francisco. And like there's no real barrier to, I think, the types of people that you can meet, the founders that you can help and provide advice to. Like, I think that, you know, all those barriers kind of disappear in a lot of ways.
I love that. And I definitely, this is going to go perfect into my question that I want to ask Katie, because what you just talked about, 24, you have a VC job. That's like the job that's one of those coveted jobs in the world, this global network. And so this question comes to me a lot because I very different. I'm 33, but because I live in New York as well, but I had no network. I came from a really small town in the middle of nowhere in Colorado, didn't know a single person on the East Coast. And when I was an entrepreneur, I was trying to do these things. I was going to all these events in person, of course, and they were saying, oh, it's not about what you know, it's who you know. And the way that you get introduced to me as a VC is by a warm email from someone that we both know. And I'm like, but I don't know anyone. So I went and did exactly what you're talking about, but it was a grind. I was spending hours and hours every night building out my social network. And because of that, I'd had a network globally. So it's so spot on. But Katie, so thank you for that, Megan. I want to go to you for a second, because when we think about the world of online investing and that community piece again, there are groups that are naturally, unfortunately, overlooked. What do you think about, you know, why is this movement to online so crucial, especially for those typically overlooked groups from your perspective, Katie?
I think one of the genesis behind the founding of Public and the approach of using social to help people connect was the idea that there was something fundamentally off and toxic around the culture of the stock market that was creating a psychological barrier to entry for a lot of people. If you think about references to investing or finance in pop culture, you get Wolf of Wall Street, the, you know, 80s movies, very sharky, inaccessible and homogenous. I think over time that has an effect on people. When growing up, every financial services product commercial has nobody in there that looks like you or that you can relate to. And so I think one of the powerful things about social media and the community we're building at Public, we're a million plus members, 40% women, 45% people of color, is that you see that representation in that environment. And you actually see that, you know, in the feed that's next to your portfolio. And it's kind of an affirmation that, yeah, you belong here, you can do this. And I think when you think about what really bonds communities, it's common goals and interests, yes, but also I think the most powerful communities are diverse. And what I love about our community is it's such a wide breadth of investors. You have seasoned investors in there, you have founders, you have VCs, you also have, you know, working class people who are learning along the way. And it's so interesting when we have conversations in the app. I remember a few weeks ago, we were talking about Amazon and their unionization and that whole debate. And there were a lot of Amazon workers who were Public members talking about their personal experiences. And when you can blend people's lived experiences, we all get smarter. We all get more well-rounded. And so I think that representation and also the tone setting of communities to make sure they are inclusive and welcoming is super important. We have that right in our onboarding, making sure there's ground rules on Public. You see people commenting all the time. If a debate starts getting heated up, someone will chime in and say, hey, this isn't Facebook, this is Public. And I think that's important too, because there has been communities obviously that exist around investing and trading online. They haven't always been educational or inclusive in nature, and that just keeps people out.
Oh my goodness. I had at least 3 tweetable moments there. And I was like, should I look away for long enough to send this tweet, or I'll just wait to send them later? Because you articulated that so well. So I really appreciate that, Katie, because you hit on so many key things. And let's just go there for a little bit longer, if you don't mind. Lisa, I would love you to jump in here on this same concept. Obviously, you do a lot, my dear, but one of the things you do is angel investing. So can you talk about the importance of the, you know, overlooked groups from an angel perspective and how you think about it from an investment thesis perspective as well?
Yeah, definitely. When you invest in companies, especially startups at the earlier stage, you are literally choosing the types of leaders who will be running the future Fortune 500s, who are going to be creating the world that you want to see. And so I think about it, it's, you know, you vote with your dollar, literally, for what kind of leaders you want to put into power and build the type of world we want to create. And, you know, my investment thesis as an angel investor really just boils down to, I invest in badass women who are creating companies by women for women. And in particular, I'm really passionate about women's health, because I see the way women's bodies are treated in the system, essentially as small men. And like, our bodies are so different. And the reason why there isn't the sort of innovation in there is because it's so hard to get funding for that, right? Female founders have never been taken seriously when they talk about things that are for women, because 94% of the VC community is men. And so I think with platforms like Republic, where you have the power now to invest in the future you believe in, invest in the leaders you believe in that are representative of the true diversity of the population, you know, you can invest in companies that align with your values at the earliest stage and be a part of that journey as you grow. And so when you look at equity crowdfunding, you know, women are able to actually have their products be invested in, have their products and services and companies leverage their local community, leverage their neighbors and their friends who are saying, yes, I actually believe this is valuable for me, and therefore I'm going to invest. And so women outperform men about 30% on average when they are fundraising through equity crowdfunding platforms through their community. So I think, you know, there's the gatekeepers when it comes to VCs, and there's the boys club. And when you see that only 2% of funding goes to women, only 0.2% goes to women of color, and then you see how different it can be when you have online communities, online investing options like Republic, you know, that's when we really start to see a long-term change.
Thank you for that. I want to build a little bit on that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts specifically, Lisa, but if either Katie or Megan want to chime in as well. So you mentioned something about the idea of, you know, voting with your dollars and you know, investing in things that are close to you, which I think makes total sense. One thing that was, if we think about some of the big things that happened last year with the big BLM movement, everything else, I just remember across all social channels, you started seeing like support Black businesses, buying Black businesses and everything else. So I'm curious, because it's a little bit different than the investment side. It's the opposite. It's the consumer behavior. But how is there a way, you know, I try to think of it, you know, big vision here. It's like, okay, so if I know I, you know, if I'm living paycheck to paycheck and I don't feel like I'm at a place where I can do some serious investing, but I do know I want to support Black women founders, and especially because I'm already buying those products. So it kind of would, you know, make more sense. Do you have thoughts on ways that we can connect those two more closely? So your spending behaviors on things you have to buy anyways, or that you want to buy for your friends or your family, has a direct correlation to your investment portfolio. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Does anyone want to chime in?
I think there are just a lot of startups that are popping up that kind of cater to sort of this conscious consumerism. And I think, like I mentioned, I talk a lot about Gen Z trends. Like, I think we are like a very socially conscious generation where, like, you know, there are plenty of companies that we've invested in on the Lear Hippo side to kind of materialize. Like, we want to be investing in brands that stand for something. Like, I believe Parade donates like a portion of their proceeds to Planned Parenthood. Like, that's something that's very important to me as a Gen Z consumer, is knowing that my dollars matter. And I think there's also verticalized marketplaces that are popping up, even on the startup side. Like, I know there's one called Radical Girl Gang, where like it's a curated marketplace for women-owned brands. Shop Latinx, I believe, is one specifically for like Latinx-owned brands. Like, I think you're seeing a lot of companies popping up that cater to those specific needs of next gen consumers, or just generally people that really do want to like make that sync between, you know, where they're putting their dollars to work and the causes they care about.
Love that. Katie, you want to add?
Yeah, I would just say, on the topic of voting with your dollars, something really interesting that we've seen is sort of the blurred lines between being a consumer and being a retail investor. So those same conversations about supporting Black owned businesses translates to the companies that people investing in stocks. It's the same idea. We even saw that in our community last year during kind of the beginnings of the BLM movement, We had a few members sharing to the feed, hey, these are the four Fortune 500 companies that have Black CEOs, and flagging and highlighting. And we actually ended up building like a curated theme in the app that factored in diversity and leadership in the boardroom and kind of curated that list to raise awareness around which companies were leading there, but also shine a light on how big that gap really is. But it is really interesting to think about as more retail investors come up, as fractional investing becomes so popular, the same people who are consuming everyday products are consuming investments in a similar way. And there's a lot of overlap there, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah. And I would also just add on, I mean, I think what we're all kind of pointing at is that purpose and profit is not mutually exclusive. And I think there needs to be more education around that. It's like, it's not charity to invest in women or to invest in Black founders. It's that if you genuinely believe that by funding these types of leaders, that is going to actually create a much more powerful and purposeful world, and it's going to make you a lot of money, which is like a thesis. It's like anytime an opportunity is underlooked, there's an opportunity to make money. And so I think it's like realizing you're doing it, of course, to create the world you want to see, but you're also doing it for yourself. And that's what investing is, right? You're building wealth. And so I don't think there has to be this conversation anymore about there's a trade-off, because I don't think there's a trade-off. It's like you invest and everyone benefits.
Love that. So we've already gotten a bit here to the women's side, but I do think I want to do a deeper dive there for a second. And I would love all three of your opinions on this. Do you think, so you all have shared, and I know Lisa, you mentioned that 94% of VCs are men, but if we think about it from the investor's perspective, individual investor's perspective, do you think that women have a competitive advantage with online investing versus traditional? I would love all three of your approaches, because I mean, you're all looking at this from different angles. So do you think that on the online platform, women have a competitive advantage? Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that women have different advantages, just like men have different advantages. And the biggest issue is that the narrative has generally taught women that we are risk averse, we can't do this, you know, and I think a lot of it has to do with changing the actual narrative of women actually realizing that they have unique advantages when it comes to investing. And these are our natural traits that we have as women, which is we tend to be more diligent. We tend to be more holistic. We tend to be more thoughtful. And when we invest, whether that's our time, our energy, or our money, I think women have a natural instinct where we want to invest in things that are creating a better world for the next generation. Like it's when we are in our power, you know, that's how we think about investing. And we think about how can we create a win-win for everyone and have that long-term perspective. So I think absolutely when you have more women investing, and to this point of purpose and profit are not mutually exclusive, we're going to see not only, you know, better investments by women, but you're also going to see more impactful investments. And I think that will shift the way our world is being built longer term.
Megan, what about you? Thoughts on this? Do women have a competitive advantage for online investing?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think like Lisa said it perfectly in terms of like women have unique advantages. I do think like, I don't think women have a specific advantage when it comes to like access to information. Like I do think social media has made like really leveled the playing field in a lot of way where like anyone can learn, anyone can like read a 10K, anyone can learn about a stock, you know, anyone can start building their personal brand online and start writing about topics. So I think that's been like, you know, especially during COVID where everyone's kind of turned their attention to Twitter, turned their attention to online, you know, online platforms where, you know, people are learning at, I think, like a faster pace than ever before. But I wouldn't say that women have a strategic advantage in like being able to invest and see, you know, longer returns. But I do think, you know, as Lisa mentioned, it's especially like everyone is going to have a unique perspective, whether it is like, hey, I'm Gen Z, I get this product and this market better than anyone. Like maybe it's Roblox because like you've lived it, you've lived that experience. And so you understand like the value prop much better. Or like if it's a women's focus brand, like, you know, we're investors in companies like Cup and Parade, you know, that focus on like underwear and lingerie, like maybe you just understand that fundamentally better as a woman. And as those companies go public, I think that lens is always existent and here where like you just fundamentally understand things because you've lived that experience.
Yeah. What about you, Katie? Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think the more kind of diversity of thought that exists in these conversations, be it online, on social, or elsewhere, the better. I think we're obviously speaking in a lot of generalizations. This doesn't apply to everybody, but you think about who buys most household items in the average American household, or, you know, there's blind spots that can exist. And when you can create communities like Public that has a diverse mix of people, it helps everybody. So again, a generalization, but I learn a lot about DraftKings in our app. I don't care about sports betting at all. Obviously, heavy male audience on their platform, but I can learn about that. On the flip side, you know, women in our community are sharing about Poshmark, which the average, you know, man in my life doesn't know anything about. And it's a really interesting business. And so what I think the benefit of these social conversations is discoverability. And just like Megan said, then once it's on your radar, everyone has that same access to the 10Ks, the earnings calls, the research. But getting it outside of those homogenous circles, I think, benefits all of us. And that's what I'm most excited about in terms of the power of community and social, because bringing all that together, it makes everybody smarter and just expands everybody's horizons when it comes to what they're considering in their portfolio.
Yeah, you know, there's a few things that sparked my mind as you were all talking. And part of it goes back to this idea around, so you talked just now, Katie, about discoverability. And I think what's really powerful about the work that you're all doing and these platforms that are enabling these conversations is if we start building some of this wealth and this experience now, then that stat that you referenced earlier about the traditional VCs, right, Lisa, with the 94% men, you know, there's a lot of, that's a whole different side of the equation, which is why are there not more women on the venture capitalist path? But if we are now ourselves doing this through these other platforms that you all are enabling, that's a lot easier to get there. So it's now, you know, now you're saying, well, I've done this personally. I've done this here. I already have all this thesis. I already have this education. And naturally then that part of the cycle will start, because one of the things that kind of keeps me up at night is there's a lot, which is we need to start somewhere. There's a lot of work that's been done on the earlier pieces, investing your own money here and there. But then with these women companies, there tends to be a bit of a point where they kind of hit a brick wall, because the big, big dollars are still tend to be monopolized by men. So if we can get more women in those places, now their growth capital comes. So I just think there's a lot of opportunity for movement there. So I want to go back to you, Megan, because there's one thing that, you know, I've been in the financial service world for some time now, and I did not mean to come into this world. I graduated a time shortly after the last financial crisis, and I had a very negative perception of the financial world. But one of the things that surprised me is I started kind of getting under the hood of what it is that we were doing. And I've always looked at it from the tech side, but is that even with people within the space whose job is within financial service, they don't understand. They're not putting money towards their 401k. They're not thinking about long-term this, that, or the other. And there is a bit of a taboo around, more broadly around health and wealth. People don't like talking about that. They're happy to show anything else online, but those are the two things that they tend to keep rather private. So I'm curious from your perspective, Megan, why do you think that financial health and wealth is one of those taboo topics? And is there anything that we can do to kind of normalize a conversation? Because there's a lot of power there, even for us when we think about being paid less from, you know, a salary perspective. Part of the reason that you'll know that is because you talk to other people about it. So I'm just curious how you're thinking about that, Megan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all starts from education. And I think it's just because, like, even I think it starts in high school, right? Like, you're not like in classes, like women aren't taught like, oh, like you should start saving, you should start talking about your finances. I think like people just always naturally associate finance with men for some reason. And that starts at a very early age. But I know there are organizations that I think starting especially in college, where like women are finally being immersed in like financial services in different ways. Like I personally was a scholar at Girls Who Invest. Their goal is to have 30% of the world's assets managed by women by 2030. And that was my first exposure to the world of asset management broadly. Like, what is it? how should I start thinking about investing both personally and professionally, and also opening the doors for more women to actually start careers in financial services. Like, I don't think I would be at Lear Hippo now or at General Atlantic before if it weren't for Girls to Invest, because they were the ones that kind of like got me hooked. And now we have 500 plus, I think, alumni that went through the program. I'm on the advisory board. So I think it really does start with education. And, you know, I think I could be doing a better job of that. Like, I think like sometimes my friends and I will be talking about how we're like, are we doing our 401k match? Like, how should we be thinking about like our investing outside of work? But for some reason, just women don't talk about it. Like, I remember one of my first internships, it was me and five other men. I was the only woman in this program. And all we talked about all the time was like their investments, how much money they were making, how much money they were losing, what they were buying. And, you know, when I would leave work and then go hang out with my girlfriends, like that didn't come up at all. Like, I think like sometimes you just kind of have to start the conversation and things move from there. But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of work to do on that front in terms of education and, but we're getting there.
I probably got about a decade on Megan. And I just, the fact that you had Girls Who Invest in college is like amazing. And at public.com, we work with a ton of like college organizations. And every time I'm like, man, I wish this was cool when I was in college, and it wasn't. And now I feel like a lot has changed. Like, there's a long ways to go, but I feel like, and you probably can speak to this better than me, I sense that it's now like cool to be entrepreneurial and good with money and understanding of these things as a woman, and even in college. And that was just not the case when I was there. And I just love talking to Gen Z people in this group, because I think it is so cool. And I have so much FOMO that it wasn't that way when I was a student in college.
I think part of it too is like, I think we're living in such an experience driven economy right now, where like everyone is hungry for experience. It doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. And like, internships are such a great way to do that. And like, oftentimes, exactly, like exposure to those types of programs like Girls Who Invest, like it's so empowering for women to be able to say like, I know what I want to do with my career, and I'm taking the steps to be able to get there. Doesn't matter where you go to school, doesn't matter what you studied, like we are going to help provide you with the tools to be able to, you know, do this on your own, do this for your career. So I mean, I might be biased. I thought it was very cool when I was a freshman. And I think it's still very cool. And I talked to lots of scholars that love it. But it's like, it's great. Like, I didn't go to a target school. My parents don't work in finance. Like, and I'm, again, much younger than the average investor. Like, theoretically, like I shouldn't be in venture capital right now. But because of those types of programs and that education, I am, and I'm so grateful for it. So I sing their praises all day long. And I do think it's pretty cool as well.
Yeah, and there is a huge opportunity from an educational component. I think we've talked about that at length, and it's such an important one. I think the other side of it too, so I will agree with Katie, I have FOMO, I didn't have any of that. But I also think back to myself at that time, and, you know, talking about things like 401k, and not only was I not aware of that, but I graduated undergrad with $120,000 of student loans. So my first thought was definitely not like, and by the way, I couldn't do internships. It's changed a little bit now, but there were basically not a lot of paid internships for me, and I was paying my own way through college. So I felt like, you know, I didn't have those opportunities, and I tried to get creative. I was like, I have to find a way. I did the math. It was way more expensive for me to live on housing, on campus housing, versus going and getting a room share in New York. I mean, it's crazy, but it was true. It was actually a big difference. But when I think back to those things, there is certainly the educational piece. There was stuff that I would gravitate towards, even if that was applicable to me today or 5 or 10 years from now, at least I would know, at least I would be excited about it. But I do think we also have, as a collective, more responsibility on talking about the behavioral components, the financial components, to get people comfortable, because we can say, well, we'll teach you, this is what happens. This is what compound interest is like. Here's if you put this amount of money, here's what happens. But there are still huge subsets of our population that are so concerned about getting food that week or doing what else for their family that month. And so there's definitely, you know, I think a balance there. Which gets hard too, back to the FOMO stuff earlier when we were talking about getting into crypto and FOMO there, because it's like, I have family members across the country, some of them in some of the poor areas in the South, and you know, they have a little bit of savings, but they're taking, instead of going on their family vacation, they decided to invest in crypto. I'm like, not sure that was the best, you know, best move for you and your family. So there's a whole other component I think we really need to spend some talking about. So really quickly on the crypto kind of stuff and investment more broadly, I want to go back to you on this, Katie. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about investing and where we've come from and where we're going. I think I would love to hear your perspective. Social media, the influence of social media that's happened with investing, like, should social media have the influence that it does? Should someone like, let's just say, you know, a very big owner of Tesla be able to make a tweet and have the stock markets react that way? I'm just curious, what is your thoughts on kind of the impact of social media on investing?
Well, I'm not going to touch the regulation piece. I have my own personal opinions there, but I'll stay away from that. But I do think you could look at it an optimistic view, pessimistic view. I look at this stuff coming into the mainstream, again, not speaking to regulation, but just generally, as a net positive. When you have mainstream news outlets and personalities talking about these topics, what it does is it gets it on a lot of people's radar. A lot of people, if no one learns this stuff in school, tiny fraction of people learn it from their parents if they happen to be in upper middle class, upper class. Most people will never hear about these things, and it's just not on their radar. And so if you see your favorite celebrity tweet something about holding Dogecoin, is that the most responsible thing for the celebrity to do? Probably not. But now they're like, huh, what's Dogecoin? What's crypto? How does that work? What is this? And I think for a lot of people, it sparks curiosity that just wasn't there before and provides a pathway to learn that didn't exist. And so I look at that stuff from a sense of, yes, it's great that this is mainstream. Let's get it more out into the open. With that, I think they're similar to politics. Media literacy is really important. Where do you get good information about this stuff? Even in the investing world, you see all the time articles, 5 hot stocks for July. Operates the same way as any other headline. It's clickbaity. They want traffic. And so educating people on media literacy in the financial space, I think, will be increasingly more important the more mainstream these topics become.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. Lisa, I'd love your opinion on this, but I'm gonna go a little bit more specific because, you know, I made the reference to a very powerful man on the crypto side, but let's talk about, you know, the move towards all investing in crypto. Why? I mean, I've sat in plenty of these rooms where I just want to sit and learn, and I'm often one of the only women. I'm just curious, from your perspective, why do you believe that there aren't more women investing in crypto and all assets more broadly? And how do you see this changing as we go?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've touched upon this quite a bit in terms of a big part of the structural narrative just needs to change the way women are socialized to think about investing. With a lot of the coaching that I do when I work with women on financial confidence, you know, I think first is like, let's cut ourselves a little bit of slack. You know, women could not get credit cards without the signature of a husband or a father 50 years ago. You know, it's only really in this generation that we've had the opportunity to even pursue, you know, senior level positions in companies. And so I think we forget how much progress there's been. And so it's like, of course, it's hard to talk about money. Of course, there's like residual shame from the past, but that's, you know, that's part of the system's fault, really. And at the end of the day, it's like the financial system was created by men, for men. It's still dominated by men. You know, even if you think of the language, like the bull run, the spread, like it's very masculine language, and it's like not the way that women speak. And I think words are important because that's how we communicate values. That's how we learn about things. And so it is intimidating. You know, I was at the Bitcoin conference a couple of weeks ago, and it's swarming with men, you know, and that's not new. I started on Wall Street, went into venture Silicon Valley, and now entering this space. And, you know, some of the stats are that 74% of crypto owners are men, 71% are white. And the average crypto owner is a 38-year-old white man who makes over 100K a year. And that is not the majority of our population. And if you enter those sorts of rooms where you know, as you mentioned, like, you're different. I thought about, how would my female friends feel even in these networking situations? You know, I've kind of gotten used to it and learned how to conduct myself. And I'm sure, you know, every woman on this panel as well, but it's intimidating. And I think that with some of the advances in community and online investing, what we talked about from the very beginning is we're going to start creating those safe spaces where it's okay to ask stupid questions, because there is no such thing as a stupid question. And that's how we learn and that's how we grow. And so I think that building that confidence for women and having those safe havens to do it is what's going to ultimately change it long term. And, you know, as it pertains to crypto, I think there's, with the system that's built by and for men, there's a true opportunity for women to get involved. It's still a very nascent industry, and become active participants and actually shape a new financial digital system that caters towards us. And with the blockchain technology, you know, the values of it are around transparency and community and connection, because there is no middleman, you know, and there is no like literal old rich white middleman controlling it. So I think that I'm really excited about it. I think I'm very optimistic about more diverse people just and more women coming into the space and investing.
I love that. So we have 15 minutes left and a ton of questions that I still have, but I am getting questions from the audience. So let me get to two of those quickly, because I want to make sure we incorporate them in here. One of them is definitely for the three of you on social media. So I'll do that one next. But let me go back to you real quickly, Lisa, because this is specifically for you. What is your advice for professional athletes who would be interested in investing for the first time?
Yeah, so I think first, for any new investor, I think the biggest hurdle is the mental part, is like believing you are an investor and even like attaching yourself to that label. And once you say it, you can start empowering yourself to learn. And so as an athlete, you know, I was a gymnast for 10 years and that was my core identity. And what I realized in terms of the most important things I learned as an athlete, I think that helped me succeed now, is how to fall over and over again. And publicly, I would fall, you know, as a gymnast in front of hundreds of thousands of people. And no matter how bad or embarrassed or shameful that felt, I always got back up again. And you put on a smile and you keep performing and you keep going. And that has served me as an entrepreneur, right? A lot of times they say the people who succeed are just the ones who get back up and keep going. And that's also what served me as an investor, because as a gymnast, I said, I have a 10-year goal. And that decade-long goal is to participate in the Olympic Games. And so every time there was a bad competition, you know, think about it in terms of a metaphor of like, you know, stock market dips, the startup doesn't do well. You ride those dips and you're like, it's cool because I've got that 10-year vision, that thesis for my life. And so what I would recommend for new investors, you know, regardless of if you're an athlete or if you're just someone coming in, is really think about, what's your 10-year vision for how the world will be? And once you have figured out the type of world you want to invest in, you can start aligning your investments with those values and that vision. And you can ride the dips, you can ride the volatility, even if you don't understand every single nuance and detail. And, you know, that I apply, again, those traits as an athlete into being an investor, because even with crypto, like, I don't understand the intricate technicalities of exactly how blockchain technology works. And that might prevent a lot of people from getting into it because they have imposter syndrome. But what I do know is that those values of transparency and community and connection align with how I see my vision for the world. And I see the opportunity of creating a different world where more diversity is leading the way. So that's why I invest in it. And I can ride through that volatility because I know I always will get back up again.
I have to say, when you were giving that answer, I mean, all of your answers have been brilliant, but that one, the passion and your eyes and your voice, when you started talking about that journey, you could just feel it through the screen. Okay. So one more there's a few from the audience, but let me just do one now and then we'll go back a little bit, because we now 10 minutes, girls, we got a lot in front of us. Okay. So One of the questions that came in, which is an interesting one, it was kind of building off of Megan, what you and Katie and I were talking about the young people investing. So the question is, are there concerns that many young investors do not necessarily understand basic finance and are highly influenced by social media? So whoever wants to take that.
I mean, I can start. Like, I remember, I think Thomson Reuters interviewed me maybe a few months ago. This is one, like, I mean, I think there's a lot of, like, I think Robinhood's been in the news in a few negative aspects because of this. Like, they're not educating users at the get-go. And I'm sure Katie has a lot of thoughts here on how public is doing things differently. But I do think the education portion and building education and community into these types of platforms is so incredibly important because, like, sometimes this is people's first, you know, time interacting with, you know, fractional shares and options, and they might not necessarily understand the risks up front, especially if you're younger and this is your first time investing. And that's why the community powered, like, and, you know, bringing those barriers down so anyone can ask a question, learn from one another is so incredibly important because, like, you know, at the end of the day, there is, you know, it is investing, like, not everything is a sure bet, but there are ways to mitigate those risks through education, through community, and why I think, like, the power of community driven investing is just so important.
Katie, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think one of our big things at Public is the idea of access with responsibility. And so I think if you're a tech platform that facilitates something that or makes something more seamless that was harder before, especially involving money, there's an onus on you to also build features in the product that educate. And so while we never want to tell people how to live their lives, people have different risk tolerances, different, you know, views on money. We want to make sure that for those new people coming in, that they don't accidentally do something just because of sheer ignorance. And so that's why I think context is really important. So we do things like put safety labels on stocks that are volatile or risky per the SEC. And somebody actually has to read and acknowledge that label before they proceed with the investment, similar to how Twitter has the feature that makes sure you read something before you retweet it. Things like that. We also don't offer margin accounts or options trading. We're 90% novice investors. So we're really trying to always balance access to the ability to trade freely with content that helps you. But the second thing I want to say is I do think a lot of the coverage of this new wave of investors has been just assuming they're all just morons who are buying GameStop, following some tweet, or Dave Portnoy or whoever. And I think we're selling a lot of these people short. I think with fractional too, the beauty of it is you can start small and learn without having a lot of skin in the game. We have a lot of college students on the app that have like $20 in their portfolio, but wow, what would I have loved to have that as a college student as I was learning, where the, you know, the risk of what you could lose is much smaller. And so yes, we want people to be informed, but I think it's a negative kind of take to think that just because your first foray in the stock market was AMC, that you can never possibly learn how it works, or you could never possibly build a portfolio that's diversified. I think that's just the kind of the new entry point for people. My entry point was my first 401k at work. And guess what? I didn't really know what was going on in there for like 7 years anyway. So I think we got to kind of look to the future and then say, like, okay, how can companies like the ones we're all at help get people to that next level using technology?
Yeah, and you made a great point, right? In that there is naturally this generalization of an oversimplification of they're brand new, so they don't know what the hell they're doing. And even if there are subsets of that group that's true, that is okay if it's, as long as it's not, you know, I gave you some extreme examples from my family, but as long as it's not your entire savings, but maybe you think about it as, instead of going out that Friday and getting drinks at, you know, at the bar, using that money to invest, or instead of doing, I'm not going to indulge in my Starbucks coffee for just 1 week, just so I can dip my foot in the pool and kind of test out to see what's happening there. All right, let me actually get to one more of the audience questions and then we can wrap up going back a little bit more to crypto, because I know we got a lot of crypto comments between the three of you. So this one's pretty interesting because we've been doing a fair amount of talking about women investing and from all assets and more broadly, but this attendee said, what should, in your opinion, women be investing in?
I think we've said this quite a bit already. It's First of all, diversify, you know, just make sure you're not putting all of your money into one thing. But I think it at the end, you have to invest with your values, invest in the future you believe in. Because if you are just investing and following the hype, which is, I think, the one thing you should never do is don't follow the hype. Invest in things that you know and invest in things you believe in. Because if you invest in things just because of the hype, you are going to, that fear, you know, when things drop, you're going to sell and you're going to lose money inevitably. But if you're investing in something for the long term and you're like, I really believe in this company, I really believe in this leader, I believe in this industry, then you're going to be able to ride those waves. And ultimately, that it's long-term investing that really gets you to a place where, you know, that investment pays off. And quite honestly, you know, as an investor myself, I don't want to spend all day like buying and selling and trading because I've got better things to do. You know, like I'm not here to make a penny here or there. I want to do my research, invest in the things I believe in, and then hold that and really follow the journey and learn as I'm doing my investing.
That's a great point. Megan or Katie, anything you want to add? I mean, I think we've kind of hit this pretty hard. My only thing that I would say is you're 100% right, but exactly what you say, I think is true, whether or not, however you identify, it's invest with your values, because there are plenty of people who are new to investing and I would give them the same advice, you know, regardless. Okay. So we're getting short on time here. So what I would love to do is give you each an opportunity to share any final thoughts, key takeaways, asks for the audience, because I mean, a lot of this stuff, we have this live audience now, but I know the Yield Street team does a great job of submitting this stuff later as well. So any takeaways from each of you? What do you want the audience to leave with? Any stats, any asks? Let's do it.
I can start. I will say, I think especially for the younger folks in the audience, I think taking that first step is always the hardest. But once you start, you just take off from there. So I think trust yourself, trust your values, and you'll be happy that you started when you did. So don't be afraid to get your feet wet. And if you're looking for a friendly place to get started, I would check out Gen Z VCs, especially if you're interested in startups. But that's my plug. And I'll turn it over to the other ladies.
I can go next. I have a couple of plugs. You know, one is if you're interested and if this piqued your interest in angel investing, head over to republic.co, check out the startups, read the stories about the companies that are raising. And then secondly, this is a new exciting project I just launched, and it's for the crypto curious women out there. So I just launched my new podcast, Bitcoin is My Boyfriend. And it's diving into the crazy world of cryptocurrency, crypto bros, infiltrating them, maybe taking their Bitcoin. But the whole point is really to help women take control of their money, their careers, their relationships. And what I want to do is to help make money and investing pleasurable and fun. And I think that's really how we'll change the conversation. It's like when it feels good. And I think that like when women feel good, we're literally unstoppable. And so if we're able to have those combos, we're laughing and we're learning. That's my goal with the Bitcoin is My Boyfriend podcast. So you can check that out. The trailer just dropped yesterday and we'll be dropping every week.
All right. I love that. Okay. What about you, Katie? You got your own podcast?
I don't, but I will definitely be listening to Lisa's. And there's another one I listen to that I'll plug called Girls Just Want to Have Fun. My friend Syra runs that with her best friend, and it's really good. And on that note, I think my big takeaway, I think I'm relatively new to fintech. This is my first job in financial services. And just even joining the community on Twitter around finance was very intimidating at first because it is such a male-dominated culture. And I think sometimes when women enter those spaces, they think they need to change their behavior to match what exists. But I think what you're seeing is we can help actually evolve the existing community and evolve the existing culture and find other women in this space. And so I see this a lot even in crypto, which I'm not super deep into, but it seems like even more male dominated than the stock market. So to the extent that women can uplift other women and have each other's backs in these spaces, I think it's so important. And I think, you know, Republic does an amazing job of this. And also just Megan, you building your platform in your industry is just so valuable. And so let's have more of that and less trying to kind of fit into what it had existed in the past.
I love it. I think you're absolutely right. As someone who has been in this fintech world now for a half decade plus, it is that combination of finance, which is already lots of men, and then tech, which, so you have the two combined, which is a pretty special and interesting place. I will say my one plug. So for Money 2020, we are the global kind of pinnacle event for financial services and fintech. One thing that would be really interesting, and I think you all would be perfect for it, we actually have a special program called Rise Up for Women. And we have one now for the Black and Brown community as well called Amplify, where it's, the event is huge. You have thousands of people, 10,000 plus. And then this is a very specific curated event for women, by women. There are men who are part of it, and we were very intentional about that, right? Because there's a lot of lessons to be learned from these guys who are helping to accelerate and build kind of the next version of badasses. And anyways, so there's a lot that's happening there, and we're live in October in Vegas from the 24th to the 27th, and in Amsterdam from the 21st to the 23rd of September. So lots of good parts here, but I'm so thankful for all of your time. This was, we could be talking for hours, and I hope that we get to do this again, because it was a lot of fun. And thank you all for participating, asking questions. We have a lot more to come, and I have a new thing on my list to go listen to, the Bitcoin is My Boyfriend, because I'm excited about that one. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we appreciate, if you have any specific questions, you know, like I said, so thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.